Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now, to week two of our new Open House series on the whole Bible. We're nothing if not adventurous on Open House. We just thought, on the back of the primetime Channel 9 series called The Bible, having seen the story, we'd delve into it and explore what it all actually means. Leading us through it all is pastor, author, broadcaster Nick Hawkes, who has himself written a special edition of the whole Bible for Asian church planters. Last week, we kicked off the series with an absorbing conversation about the Bible's beginnings, well worth catching on the podcast page of our Open House community website. Tonight, the Bible's prophets, kings, and then Psalms. What are they all about? What sense can we make of a pretty complex sweep of history? What's their story mean for us? Nick Hawkes will shed light for us. Nick Hawkes, welcome back to Open House.
Hello, Lee. It's good to be with you
again. Great to see you again. Let's start with a broad general question, Nick, about this sweep of history. What makes it an important era for us to look at and extract some kind of meaning?
No, it's a good question. What has happened up to this point is really that God has revealed himself and chosen a people whom he has asked to represent him, to carry his glory, to carry his truth, who are going to be chaplains to the world. As mentioned in Genesis, he says to Abraham, you know, through you and your descendants, all the peoples of the earth will be blessed. And now in this section, we're looking at how it plays out. How will that people develop? How will they travel? Like a small child with a parent, making mistakes and the parent corrects, you know, just learning the craft of being a people of God. And how does that play out and the sequence and the process of events?
I think it's also helpful to explain the kinds of people we're talking about in this sweep of history. Talk to us about what a prophet is. What's the significance of the kings?
Yes. It is interesting that, whereas most of the kingdoms around the place had their authority vested in a political leader, a king, who usually claimed also to be a god because it was fairly handy to bully people with that idea, God didn't. And in fact, didn't ever really want to go in that direction, because the guiding principle for his people was to be his very presence and his word, particularly his word. That's the reason why he would encourage them, for instance, to write down the Ten Commandments, principles to live by, and to put them in a memory box made of acacia wood called the Ark, with a bunch of other stuff that reminded the people whenever they got forgetful, because the trouble with faith is that it leaks, you see. And God said, whenever that happens, just remember what's in the box, how my word changed miraculously every situation that threatened your existence. And I will continue to guide you with my word. I don't want a king, but I will choose leaders who will devote themselves to be close to me, through whom I will speak my word.
The prophets.
The prophets. And that's exactly what prophecy is. And so the key thing was that I speak my word through my chosen representative, the prophet, who foretells. Prophecy is not so much foretelling the future. It's really telling out the principles, teachings, and the wisdoms of God, which sometimes did involve saying, hey guys, if you go down this path, you're going to get hammered by this neighboring nation who's going to rise up, and they're going to be my instrument to correct you. And so this was the role of the prophet.
His desire wasn't actually for kings, but the people kept on hassling him for it, and he gave them what they wanted.
That's exactly right. God in his wisdom knew exactly what would happen, and he sort of pleaded with them rather beautifully, and said, look, do you know the significance of what you're asking? What will happen is that a massive bureaucratic thing will be built up, which will almost bankrupt you. You will no longer be sort of autonomous villages and towns, you know, fairly stable. It'll be a real burden around your neck. And I will only countenance it on this proviso, and that is that the king learns the humility of a child of God seeks me with all their heart. And so Saul, the first king of the Jews, was chosen, who started well, but then came a gutser.
Some do better than others, and a whole lot worse than others as well. It's probably worth also setting a bit of an historical, geographical context for this era.
Yes, the genius of God was that Palestine, Israel, that little bit there on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean, which was the stage upon which all this stuff happened, was in a politically disastrous area. It was between two massive kingdom groups, and both groups were represented by massive fertile rivers, because where you've got massive fertile rivers, you've got fabulous agriculture, you've got wealth, and you've got the stuff that drives big kingdoms. So down to the south, of course, you've got this magnificent River Nile. And so Egypt is always this huge monster down south, which always was coming up north and raiding poor old Palestine. And then, of course, to the northeast, you had the Euphrates and the Tigris, magnificent rivers, which gave birth to a whole succession of huge empires. And, of course, the two big empires of Egypt and the Tigris and the Euphrates hated each other. And, of course, the poor little guy in the middle happened to be God's people in Palestine. And so God said, you know, this won't be a problem if you trust me. And these guys said, nah, we'd rather... They always picked the wrong side. Yes. You know, that, yes. On a footy tipping competition, they were shockers. They always made alliances with the wrong person. And there was the prophet saying, don't do that. Please don't do that.
On behalf of God.
On behalf of
yes.
God.
Yeah. Important part of the story was the way the people of Israel worshipped. Tell us the significance of that.
Yes. There was a quandary here because there was only one God. And God had said, look, to help you understand, I'm going to give you some pretty good ideas about how I'd like to be worshipped, which in actual fact will be particularly helpful to you. It involves sacrifice, as they were always presented with the idea that they needed to be holy. That God wasn't a God who could allow you into heaven with 49% sin, you know, and 51% goodness. No, no, this needed to be addressed. And so God gave these fairly precise instructions. The group of people we've not yet mentioned, of course, are the priests. So we had these three groups of people, the prophets, priests, and kings, and all three, interestingly enough, needed to be anointed and chosen and called by God, in theory, before they could take up their roles. The difference between them was that the prophet, which was really, you know, God's favoured medium, really, spoke forth God's word. The priest essentially acted out the ritual of the temple, and the king, of course, did the ruling thing, and he really had to do it in partnership with the kings and prophets. The difficulty was that, of course, if you left people in villages doing their own thing, sort of marching up the top of the local hill, the problem was that they could very easily get their faith polluted with their own ideas, because they'd invent their own ceremonies, and they'd involve a little bit of Baal worship here and an Ashtoreth pole here, you know, borrowed from the Philistines or whatever it was. And so God, in his wisdom, said, no, come together. I'm going to centralize it. Through history, he centralized it on Jerusalem. It needs to be ordered. There are no variants. I will not share my glory with another God. And so temple worship became fairly important. The difficulty with that, what happened in one particular period of history, was that when the nation behaves badly and starts selling its own children into slavery and abusing the poor, and particularly, of course, worshipping other gods, and some dreadful kings started to sacrifice their own children to foreign gods, the God said, look, if you go down that path, then one of these big nations is going to come through and going to cut you off into captivity. And I will call them to do just that, to teach you.
And that happened.
And that happened.
Twice carted off. Explain to us what happened briefly and why that's significant.
The first big invasion, it came from the Assyrians. And the Assyrians were savage. And, of course, they came from the northeast with this magnificent Tigris, Euphrates fertility, had built this magnificent Assyrian nation. What had happened, sadly, is that the Hebrew people had divided into two, and you had 10 of the 12 tribes, which came to be called Israel, living up to the north, and two tribes, Judah and a little bit of Benjamin, down south. And sadly, rather than being in unity, worshipping the same God, they disliked each other and warred against each other. The king of Israel to the north said, hey, I'm going to join the king of Aram, and we're going to beat up the Assyrians. And Judah was a little wiser and said, don't do that. And then Israel said, we don't like you telling us not to do that, so we're going to invade you instead because you're horrible. What Judah did was said, Assyria, can you just come and give us a bit of a hand? Assyria came sweeping down, and they were merciless. And they invaded the northern 10 tribes of the Hebrew people, and they completely deported them. They depopulated the land, and they never recovered from that. So they were deported and exiled, but they never returned. This is a huge chunk of God's people never to return. Now, you kind of would have thought that that would have been a bit of a salutary wake-up call to the yes. team down south, the Judean team. Now, to be fair, the Assyrians weren't particularly gracious, and they did require them to pay a ruinous ransom and also began to introduce their own gods, you see. And so the Judean people started to lose heart and wonder where God was in the scheme of things and started to embrace this stuff and start to do terrible things. And they lost morality, they lost integrity, they lost everything. And so up pops Isaiah and a bunch of other prophets and says, I'd hoped you would have learned the lesson of history. Please shape up, because there's another nation that is coming up which will challenge the Assyrians. And these are the Babylonians. But they paid no attention. So sure enough, the Babylonians came in and they carted off Judah in a series of waves into captivity. And you would have thought that it was all over for the Jewish history, that the Jews had gone the ways of the Amorites, the Meatibites, and the Vegemites. I mean, they're totally gone, which you don't hear of anymore in the Hittites, which you don't hear of anymore in history. But God's eye was upon them, and that was not the end of the story.
Which is the significance of the fact that the plan continues despite all this. And partly connected with this was a great connection that the Jews had with their land. For a number of reasons, it had huge meaning.
Yes, it did. Because, I mean, it comes right back, of course, to the time when God made this promise to Abraham that this would be the land that he would give to his people. So it had a terrific sense that it was God's provision for them. But what was curious was the incredible closeness with the productivity of the land to the faithfulness of the people. And so the language which keeps recurring throughout the Old Testament was, the land is defiled because of you, and will be briars and thorns and da-da-da-da. So it wasn't just a moral desert, it literally was a physical one as well. And it's quite extraordinary how the two came together, that somehow or other, when people submitted to the will and purpose of God, almost the land itself seemed to respond and rejoice and become productive. And to some extent, this is understandable. I mean, if you're busy fighting each other and scratching at each other, you're destroying each other and you're not able to farm in a creative way. There's no trust in terms of trade. There's no wealth and productivity. You are wide open to foreign abuse. You do not care that God considers his creation to be special.
And flourishing.
That's right. Way back in Genesis, he says, look, this is my creation. You are to be stewards of it. It's like a gardener taming an unruly garden so that it becomes productive. You are the viceroy of God for that. And so when we travel with God and respect his creation, that causes God to smile. It's a beautiful thing.
Nick, you mentioned him before. Probably the most significant prophet of all of the Old Testament prophets was Isaiah. What made him so special?
Well, he, of course, presided over such a huge period of time. His name, first of all, literally means the Lord saves, which is beautiful, isn't it? The Lord saves. And so here we have a prophet having to say a lot of tough stuff to his people. But never forget this. The Lord saves. And it was absolutely appropriate. Isaiah was probably written sometime after 701 BC. That was at the time when the Assyrians had marched, that they'd invaded the northern kingdom, pretty much destroyed it and carted its people off, never to return. But then they came down to Jerusalem, to Judah, and they lay siege to it. And God very miraculously rescued them from that horrendous disaster, that siege. But the people very soon became complacent again about the Lord's deliverance. And so it was the role of Isaiah to say, no, there's another kingdom coming, which God will use to insist on holiness from his people.
and carted off to Babylon. And the significant thing about that was that the people were getting to a stage where, look, we've got the temple in Jerusalem. We've got the rituals. Therefore, you know, God's with us. Have a nice day. And so, of course, suddenly the Babylonians rock up and they cart them off into captivity. Oops, no temple. Does this mean that God doesn't exist anymore? And that's when the prophets come back and say, no. God's word has never left you. God's word is still spoken to you through the prophets. We can make sense and explain to you why this calamity has taken place. It's not that the gods of the Babylonians are stronger than the God of the Hebrew people. It's just that God of the Hebrew people has allowed the Babylonians to fulfill his purpose in teaching you a lesson for you being such horrible, horrible people.
And when you look back with today's eyes on what Isaiah was saying to them, he was holding out a hope for the future.
That's right. Running like a thin seam of gold through motherlode earth, which is wonderfully poetic.
Love it.
Yeah, thank you. Through the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, which are almost unremitting grumpiness. They're actually proclaiming the judgment of God. Hey, guys, shape up. But running through it, always, God longs to restore his people. And this theme runs through the opening 39 chapters in amongst the overwhelming judgment of God on his people. But there's always this hope, This pleading of God is there. And then, of course, the dreadful thing happens. They get carted off into captivity. And so the voice of Isaiah has to change. It's not shape up. Otherwise, you're going to get carted out. Now they have been carted out into captivity. And so the voice of the prophet rather beautifully changes and says, hey, look, you're here because you behave badly, but there is hope. And therefore, the theme of hope and God's rescue, the volume of that is increased fantastically right through to the end of Isaiah.
And as he speaks more and more, you can see more and more light being shed on the one to come.
That's right,
Jesus,
of course.
Yes.
It is curious. There are prophetic sections, many prophetic sections in Isaiah. They exist like a three-stranded rope. Suddenly, the language seems to vague out of what's been talking about. And it has a sense of disconnectedness in time. And they're fairly easy to spot because you suddenly seem to sort of drift off and talk about things which have relevance in three ways. First of all, many of the prophecies are relevant for the immediate history of the time. So that's one strand. Second, they espouse principles which are true for all of time. This is the second strand. And the third strand is that it points to a future where God's ultimate victory will occur and he will kick the winning goal. And so we have peerlessly the servant psalms that occur on four occasions throughout Isaiah and Isaiah 53, which is the most beautiful prophecy, profound prophecy of the life, mission and ministry and death of Jesus.
Nick, finally, I think it's worth touching on another very significant dynamic of this era, and that's the compilation of what we know today as the Old Testament Book of the Psalms. What makes them so important, and what can we take out of them?
Well, there are 150 of them, and they were very old, some of them, in origin. They're being collected together in books somewhere later after the Jews had returned from Babylonian exile. They were compiled into one book. What I love about the Psalms is they're earthy and they're real. And so one third of the Psalms is extolling, rejoicing in the glory and splendor and truth of God. It is just straight praise. It's magnificent, which is the reason why they're used today very much for that purpose. Another third is whinging, is just complaining, is saying our lot is horrible. Quite often the Psalms might begin that way. And then it's almost as if the psalmist says, yeah, but then I look at you, Lord, and you are fantastic. And then it sort of becomes the psalm of praise. So one third praise, one third is whinging, and one third is really intercession. It's pleading with God, Lord, please. And, you know, I reckon that's just described my prayer life pretty exactly. How about you?
Yeah, a lot of people, I'd say.
So the beautiful earthy truth. People, when they're going through times of grief and trauma in life, very often turn to the Psalms because there's the lovely honesty. So the Christian religion and the Jewish religion is not an unearthed, ethereal philosophy. It's deeply grounded in the truth and reality of life, and I love that.
Nick Hawkes, it's a very absorbing series. And we're moving through to the arrival of Jesus in our time and space, which we'll cover next week in our series. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House.
God bless.
See you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.